record show of Senator Sackett. Albert are here. At this time, I'd like to take up Senate Bill 85. And we'll pick up Senate Bill 85, then set aside for a while to take up the other two bills. But we have Senator Paul Fisher would like to testify on 85.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's just by way of a comment. I was one of the original sponsors of the bill, which asked for complete repeal of the certificate of need. In the process of hearings through the House committee, I came to the conclusion that, and went along with the committee substitute, which you have before you, seems to me to be an acceptable compromise to both the hospitals and the insurance industry. So I'm here to speak on behalf of passage of committee substitute Senate Bill 85. So if there's any questions, but that's why I have so.
Are there any questions by any members?
Why? Yeah.
What I'm going to do is just have Senator Paul Fisher speak for the bill, which he did, and then if there are any questions, then we'll set the bill aside, take up two other bills. By then, Senator Joseph should be here, and we'll take it back up at that time.
Okay, that's fine. I have questions.
Okay, thank you, Paul. At this time, we'll take up Senate Bill 186. And do you have anybody to testify or not?
Yes, sir. We have Bob Orr from Rural West.
Okay, Bob, would you take the stand and give your name and who you work for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Orr, LOHR, and I'm the Executive Director of Rural Alaska Community Action Program. And I'd like to speak today in support of Senate Bill 186, and act relating to named recipient grants. RuralCAP has been named as the recipient of legislatively directed grants in the past, and most recently, a variation on that type of designation was the federal budget impact fund process, where we applied to the fund, received the unanimous support of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for an allocation from the fund of $325,000 for rural community development, specifically focused on energy issues. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee acted to support RuralCAP's proposal on October 18th, 1982. On October 25th, then-Governor Hammond directed the Division of Energy and Power Development to expedite the funding of this proposal. Despite the fact that a full application was submitted to the Legislative Budget and Audit, and actually through a very complex clearinghouse process through the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and then routed to the State Department of Commerce and Economic Development for review and comment. After the decision was made to award the grant, there were extensive negotiations required with the Department of Commerce that took a total of 95 days beyond the governor's decision date for award of the funds. And during that time, there were substantial attempts made by the department to increase the scope of work beyond that approved by the governor and by Legislative Budget and Audit. All of this time, the amount of time available for RuralCAP to accomplish the work in rural communities was being foreshortened because there was no complementary extension of the lapse date. We still face a lapse date of June 30th, but the actual signing of a grant by the division did not occur until January 28th. Effectively, we have in 5 months to accomplish a 12-month work program, and yet we're held to the same standard of accountability as we've had a 12-month period in order to accomplish the work. So I think this is symptomatic of the low priority which state agencies tend to assign to legislatively directed grants. I think very often nonprofit organizations tend to fill gaps between between state agencies and the services that they provide. And state agencies are sometimes the least able to see these gaps or acknowledge the importance of what's being filled. I believe this bill would address that concern and basically deliver a clear message to state agencies to get off the dime and to make the pass-through of funds to the designated agencies in a timely manner. And to that end, we support this legislation.
Are there any questions by committee members? If not,
One question. In the wording, it's a named recipient, which is not a municipality. What if that said, which is not in a municipality? Is your problem in areas where you have no municipality?
No, it's both, because of course RoCap is in the municipality of Anchorage as far as its legal office, and that would not address it. The jurisdictional problems are still there, even if there are municipalities.
Okay, thank you. Dave, would you state your name? Do you represent the record, please?
My name is Dave Grady, and I'm representing the Lincoln Heights Central Council. And we'd like to go on record as supporting this piece of legislation. Lincoln Heights is similar to many other groups around the state that have quite an outreach into the smaller communities. And they have felt in the past that they are best suited and to have responsibility on some of the services that don't just get out to those smaller areas. The state's providing your larger, more organized areas of the state. So, for the record, I want to state that I can kind of support this legislation.
Any questions by members of the committee? No question. Thank you, Dave. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 186 in opposition to the bill or for the bill? If there are no, yes.
Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to remember all the arguments, but there were good and there were bad points of the previous administration's policy on grants and direct grants. But one of the better points was the municipalities had, at least within the municipality, the way it became done that was always go through the municipality. And there was a degree of coordination required, and the legislature had to give some, the municipality had to give some. And there was kind of give and take in that process. And what I wonder is if we provide this to the areas that are in municipalities, will we find that whenever somebody is interested in doing something that the municipal government is not in support of, there'll be a direct grant within the municipality to do that project. And in some cases, they may actually be conflicting.
In my observation of what's happened in the past is that many of our nonprofits cover more than one municipality. They're on a regional basis in the rural state. And to make them compete with the city or the municipality for certain grants puts a burden both on the nonprofit and on the municipalities. In Anchorage, where you have many nonprofits going to the municipality, I think they still have the same problem. That's beyond me to say. And I think the position letter by Community and Regional Affairs indicates that their peers to be in the fringe, but on the executive in doing this, and there's no fiscal attached.
Well, on the one hand, some appropriations that I've seen in the municipality rank up the percentage that I think is larger than it should be. I totally agree with the legislation. I just think that the process has, aside from that, provided for some give and take between legislators and local officials that has been usually positive, although also usually costing money. That's
move the bill out with the individual recommendation. All in favor, signify by raising your right hand. At this time, I know Senator Joseph came in. Senator Joseph is here and will take up the... Senate Bill 85. Again, we have Senator Paul Fisher here that testified in favor of the committee's substitute. So, Senator Jobson, would you explain your committee's substitute?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity, and I do want to speak in favor of the committee substitute as well. When I came to the Senate this year and became chair of the test committee, I was confronted with a strong request from the healthcare industry for the repeal of the certificate program, which was embodied in the original Senate Bill 85, sponsored by Senators Biggs, Paul Fisher, and Page Hahn. There were opponents of that, and there was some concern that we were entering into some uncharted ground with repeal. The purpose of Certificate of Need, as you remember, was to try to involve the public in the healthcare, the planning of healthcare facilities to avoid overbuilding facilities and bed space, and to put some controls because of the relationship, the fiscal relationship in which the state was automatically making payments for bed construction. Based on the testimony we had in the Health Committee, including, I'd say, testimony from my own committee health director, Dr. Rodman Wilson, and input from Mayor Knowles and many people in communities around the state and people in the industry, this committee substitute suspends the certificate of need program for a 7-year period. I think that's a fair compromise. We chose 7 years because really there was a long lead time in planning of health facilities. During that 7-year period, the legislature and the governor can observe how health needs are being met. But during that 7-year period, there would no longer be automatic construction money from the state based on the private sector's development of dead space. And that's fair, too, because if they're going to be free of state regulatory process. By the way, I think the effects of the certificate of need program historically have not been good. They've involved, in most cases, long delay, inflation, administrative costs, with the result at the end of that whole process generally of granting the certificate. But we think a 7-year suspension is a fair compromise, and we think that it'll give Alaska an opportunity to see how this works out. The construction, the automatic construction money I mentioned, is also suspended for the same period of 7 years. We also wanted to make this a kind of omnibus bill. And so, on the last page, the last several pages, from pages 6 to 8, there is established the Medicaid Rate Commission, which will set rates on a prospective payment basis for Medicaid and general relief medical patients. According to the Department of Health and Social Services, we're going to save from 1 to 3% of those costs because we're going to a prospective payment system. The trade-off is that there is certainty in the adopting an omnibus approach, I think that the public has extracted some quid pro quo for the relief from the certificate of need program, although I don't, as I said, feel that it really serves the public interest anyway. And I think we did a good job in the HES committee, and I would urge that the bill be reported.
Are there any questions by members of the committee? Senator Hanford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I supported this bill out of the HES committee, but I agree with the direction it's going. I got a couple of questions that kind of come to mind since then that I'd just like to clarify. On the 7-year suspension of both the certificate of need program and the capital construction program, what happens because they've left both laws in place if 6 years from now a hospital starts major construction and then after the 7th year, if there's no legislative action, applies for the capital construction grant percentage?
I don't know, maybe we can address that. I think one of the, I just say this about that. We had originally thought of a shorter suspension period, and frankly, I was impressed by the argument that a too short suspension period would lead to a kind of land rush to get in under the window and overbuild it. And I think the legislature might well want to look at this in advance of the 7 years, say, maybe 4 years from now, and make a policy determination to repeal certificate of need if it seems to be going well. I would, if I were still here, want to do that, want to look at that. But perhaps Mr. DeWitt would want to speak about the practical application. He has his turn.
In order to set these prospective rates, the bill calls for uniform accounting systems by healthcare providers, but we do provide for relief to small hospitals so that, or healthcare facilities, so that the commission can waive some of those uniform requirements or exempt a particular institution from it in the interest of not burdening
Senator Calpe.
Yeah. Another question. In the more populated areas, we basically accept the healthcare providers' statement that they're willing to forego the capital construction for a certificate of need suspension. What about the small communities where the certificate of need process really didn't cause them that much of a problem because there was obviously no other provider, no competition, and yet they're going to be now coming to the legislature for direct grant authority and construction? As I asked some questions about that, it was stated that Council Dotman was the only small hospital that had been able to get funding through the capital construction and through the percentage program because they never had the front money to do it. If that's really the case in the rural areas, you're sure that they're not losing something for not gaining anything, then that question answers itself also.
Mr. DeWitt represents a large hospital, a small hospital, urban hospital, rural hospital, and I know he has cleared this with every institution. I'm also advised that on some occasions there have been particular line items where the legislature saw fit to provide construction money. There's nothing in here that prohibits that, and I think that process will go on.
That would be the only
on a case-by-case basis. What we wanted to avoid was an automatic participation in what would now be exclusively private sector decision.
I have questions for you. Senator Joson, just reading the newspapers, I recall that there were a couple of various alternative things that they were talking about. One was to do away with the certificate needed entirely. The other one was to increase the dollar amount that they didn't have to get approval for. Why wasn't that an acceptable method of going?
You read correctly. In fact, we probably had draft committee substitutes doing just about all of that. Some people said just raise the thresholds, but there was no general agreement as to what the threshold ought to be.
and I think particularly the larger institutions didn't feel that that was going to solve their concern.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
Well, because I think they contemplate facilities that say if the threshold was $1 million, would exceed $1 million, and they would have to go through the certificate of need process as if no amendment had been made. And the second thing is that on the outright repeal, as I explained, I for one had some doubt about outright repeal. There are people who had concern about what the effect would be. One of the compromises that we inserted, which the industry accepted, is on page 4 of the bill, where the commission, which would set rates of payment to health facilities, could consider in determining the rates that a health facility would receive, whether the utilization rate within the facility had been reduced because, and I'm quoting from the bill, because of improvident or careless development of the facility. We wanted to say to the private sector, you can make these decisions, but we're sending you a signal that if the commission finds that you were improvident or careless in overbuilding, they can take that into account in setting rates. Those who testified felt, when the suspension idea was proposed, that it was workable if the period of suspension was long enough. And because, as I said, you usually, if you're going to have a major hospital construction facility, you're looking 5 to 6 years ahead of time. We chose the 7-year period.
Okay.
And I think it gives the industry an incentive to be moderate if there is a tendency, in fact, to overbuild. The fact that they know this is going to come up for a kind of sunset review, it's a reverse sunrise review, I think will tend to make them moderate any tendency.
What were the original reasons, in addition to that one, why we have on the books the certificate of need?
Well, first of all, there was a federal process, and I think during the Carter administration there was the feeling that health care costs could be kept in control by this system. There was some concern within the commission that perhaps we would be out of whack with federal requirements, incidentally, if we suspended or repealed the certificate of need process. But in fact, Alaska's laws do not presently conform strictly to federal requirements.
But there had to be some reasons for a certificate for a need.
I think I can explain it this way. The basic sense would be, again, others here are more expert, that this is an industry with its third-party payment mechanism, and with the kind of financing that goes on, particularly in communities served by only one facility, that is not controlled by the usual market controls in the free enterprise system. And therefore, because the patient who receives the service and gets insurance to pay his bill is not overly concerned about rates, the inflation factor takes off unless there is some regulatory regime.
How is that going to be held down if we repeal the certificate?
Well, it's going to be held down first because of the realization that what has actually occurred is that there is a lengthy administrative process which has resulted historically in Alaska, and I think all but one instance, in allowing the certificate to be issued, but only months after it's applied for. An expensive process, inflation sets in, and you get more costly construction. That's one factor. But secondly, a commission will exist which will set the prospective payment rate on Medicaid and GR Medical, and can, as I said, consider if there has been improvident construction by the facility seeking a prospective payment schedule, and therefore have more overhead than it should have. There are those who say that there is really no evidence that there is overbuilding, that who contend that the boards of these institutions are very responsible and prudent people, and that the whole premise of the certificate of need.
Well, that's interesting that the industry would start changing their mind right now, especially after the things that have happened within the last 10 years in Anchorage, with the attempts. I remember that then Representative Byrne was attempting to start a hospital, and they were using this vehicle to deny him and say it absolutely could not have a certificate and that there were too many goods, and you know all the arguments there. That's an interesting change that has occurred. It's got to be for some other reasons other than that one reason. I'm trying to determine what they are. And it's got to be a self-serving reason, and I want to find out, I guess. And I'm just making a statement. I'm not really asking about
I must say, though, in fairness to them, because I know this has come up before, and I have talked to Mike Burr and read some of the material from him, that it's not, for example, Providence Hospital's point of view, that they initiated a contest against the Lake Otis facility. Rather, they were, I think, drawn into the court process and required to state a position. So you might want to pursue that with them, but their view of their role in that is a little different.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get the answers, but anytime anybody changes 180 degrees in their position, and hospitals are no different than any other corporations, there has to be some reason that is to their advantage now. And they just need to find that reason now, because it wasn't to their advantage to have it repealed for the last 10 or 15 years, however long it's been there.
I'm sure Mr. DeWitt and others can speak to that.
Good.
I would only say certainly this bill has features that are to their advantage. But I think they've tried to work with us responsibly, and there are certain features that the state's advantage.
Right. No, I'm not saying that they're not responsible, but I am saying that they are businesses that are going out, so they don't have interest.
Just one other thing. On your committee substitute that you sent out, you create this commission, and in setting, I don't quite understand it yet, but you do set some particular guidelines there in terms of costs. Have you had a chance to have Health and Social Services look at this in terms of the effect of that cost?
Yes, we have that material.
Because the only fiscal note we have here is from the original bill.
Oh, no, there are 1983 sheets, I'm sure, which show. We'll supply that, Senator, because we asked for that. It might have been subsequent to the hearing, but they showed a considerable savings to the state and net savings to the state.
Even with your commission?
Oh, yes.
Where it had the power to?
Yes.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons for doing this. The belief that there would be considerable savings. I've also shared that material with the director.
Well, I might be wrong in the speech of this, but just from the backup material, everything seems to be talking to the original bill.
Right.
And the original bill is a lot different than the committee substitute, and so I think it should be reviewed and the request made. Not by you, by us.
In that light, we haven't received any fiscal note from the party.
I could be in error, but I will check that, Senator, because I had asked the department for the current information, and we have forwarded that information to OMB based on the department's input to us.
I'll ask Mackay, have you received any of that?
Mr. Chairman, we did receive. The second page of Senator Justice's letter, there's a reference to fiscal effects. However, as the third page in your backup indicates, the department was requested to provide a position paper and fiscal note, and they indicated they could not do so at this time on this. Yes, the original fiscal note position paper for the original bill is there. Will they the department testify on the bill before the next
I'd like to read the position paper and fiscal note for a committee substitute for Senate Bill 85S. Attached is the position paper and fiscal note for Senate Bill 85 for the Department of Health and Social Services. The department has been asked to provide a position paper and fiscal note on HESS committee substitute. However, the administration's Legislative Budget Review Committee has not considered the committee substitute. Legislative liaison for the department has said they are not allowed to comment in writing on the committee substitute until the LRC has reviewed it. Don Middleton, Mr. Lindsay, and Robert Bean from DHSS are scheduled to be at the committee meeting to develop the answer question.
This is
written by okay. This is by our staff through our committee.
Well, once we pass Senate Bill 52 through the House and this committee.
Thank you, Senator Joseph. Next person testifying is Mr. DeWitt.
Thank you.
questions. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Is there anybody else here that would testify in favor or opposed to the bill? What's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, unless you want it moved immediately, but I'd like to request, and I'm trying to think of who it is, I want to get a history, a good history from the very beginning on the whole question of certificate of need, the reason that it was there, the reason it's been supported for so damn long, and the consequences of what happened has happened on that. But we're making a dramatic change here. And I'm not getting the answers that I want. I feel to satisfy myself.
Okay.
Well, I find that, you know, it may be in the end that there's nothing to it, but I just feel I need to get that answer. The other thing is, if we are going to move today, I would propose that we send it to finance.
I think it has a referral.
No.
Well, in light of that position, we'll get our staff to try and get that information as fast as possible, and we'll bring this bill up again next Tuesday.
At the same time, could they get with Health Social Services and get some finite figures on this exactly what the basis to test in terms of either saving or costing monies, and how they came up with those specific costs and estimates?
Satisfied that the savings occur, which I am, that I would say, then you would not obviate the need to go to the finance.
Right.
Okay, we'll take up Senate Bill 67. Dave Hutchins, would you state your name and who you represent for the record?
Chairman of the Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association, here in support of Senate Bill 67. Senate Bill 67 makes the cost of relocating utility facilities incident to a municipal highway project the cost of the highway project. This practice in regard to municipal highway projects would then be identical to the practice relating to state highway projects. By making these utility relocation costs a part of the cost of the highway project, the local utility ratepayer is relieved of this burden. In most cases, a state grant is the funding source for the road project. In those cases, these relocation costs would be transferred to the state government. In some cases, the expense will be assumed by the municipality. When this expense is transferred from the local utility ratepayer to the local municipal taxpayer, there is no net change for residents during both roads. However, utilities, consumers, and municipalities, taxpayers are not always the same people. Fairness requires that if a municipality, if a municipal project causes the cost of relocating utility facilities, then the municipality should be responsible for that cost. It is also important that all the costs as well as all of the benefits of a proposed project be considered at the same time, at the time a municipality decides to relocate or widen a highway. Without Senate Bill 67, the municipality considers all of the benefits of the proposed project, but it only considers a part of the cost. This is a committee substitute from the Labor and Commerce Committee, which we support the committee substitute. The features of this compromise bill, one is that utility facilities must be located pursuant to a permit or easement before they're subject to this kind of assumption of cost by the municipality. So page 2, lines 3 through 6, that was one of the principal features of change that was made by the OCS. And another feature is that municipalities will pay only for relocation, not the upgrade. And that is not found in this bill as printed, but it comes from the existing definition, already existing law. And the third feature is that the transition provision for projects, there is a translation provision for projects already financed, that's section 5 of the bill. Another objection that has sometimes been raised against this bill is that it's, this is the kind of issue that should be left to the local level as a local issue. But as we see it, the local municipality, in those few instances where this situation arises, is one party to a two-party dispute, and we need someone else to make a decision. That's the reason for the legislation.
Are there any questions? No questions. Thank you, Dave. Next person.
Mr. Sharp.
Mr. Sharp. Just state your name. Who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Lee Sharp. I'm the attorney for the city of Burrow Juno. We oppose the bill. Why? About the mid-70s, a section of statutes did not directly address who was to pay for relocation expenses. That was left up to, in fact, applied only to the state as it does right now. It spoke to state right away for relocations. As a result, the permits which the state issued to allow facilities to be placed in the right of way dealt with, or at least the state had the opportunity of dealing with relocation costs, this term, the permit. Someone decided that since most of these state-funded highways are really federally funded, along with funds from the feds, that if we make this relocation cost a cost to the project, then the feds would be picking up that cost. So the utilities cost of moving would actually be transferred to the federal government, as opposed to the taxpayer, to the federal government, sort of shipping the expense out of the state. This change was supported not only by the utilities, but also by the municipalities. Now the attempt to extend it, the same idea to municipalities is being made, and the same basis doesn't exist, because municipalities don't have the option of having 90-95% funding from the feds for the roads. It's true that some of their projects are partially funded by state funds. We're going under a program like Juno where a major part of the expenses are going to come right out of the pockets of those who are benefited by the roof. So you're shifting a major dollars here, you're shifting a major cost to municipalities. Not parallel with the state. There's another difference between the state and municipalities. The state can deny permits to a utility. They don't have to allow utility state highway or state road system. The municipality doesn't have that option. There is 4205251, which is the last public utility statute. Section 5 is that public utilities have a right to a permit place their facilities, rights away, streets of the municipality. In other words, we can't deny them the right to locate their utilities, the rights away. Put that together with the definition in which is contained in this bill of cost of relocation. It says the cost of relocation of the utility is a cost of the project, notwithstanding any term of permit. So in other words, it doesn't make any difference. We negotiate with the utility as to who's going to pay for the relocation as a condition of getting the permit to locate. This overrides it. It will be paid by the municipality. So there's really no way for us to avoid that expense. The state can avoid the expense if they want to by saying, no, you're going to have to go acquire an easement through private property. And remember, public utilities do have the right to condemn for rights of way for their facilities. I think this is also going to raise a number of problems. Certainly appreciate the addition of the section that makes us apply only to facilities which are located in accordance with a valid permit or easement. However, what is a valid permit?
have what's known as a street cut or an excavation permit, pavement cut permit. You want to put something in the street, you have to get a permit to break the pavement. Utilities, some utilities that you might come in for those permits. Is that a permit, since we're contemplating, we're saying indirectly, you can put your utility there. The main purpose of that, however, is to control how they make the cut, how they repair it, which repair cases. Another situation where utilities go into streets is as a part of a subdivision. While the part, while the property is being subdivided, it is before its action, the subdivision process is actually completed and the street is formally dedicated. The planning board has approved what's known as a preliminary plat. That outlines where the streets will be. Then, as a condition of getting the final plat, some of the municipalities require the streets to be put in, with sewer, water, other improvements to be put in. So, all that property remains private property, including what is shown as streets. At that time, the owner or the developer will go to the utility and ask them to put in underground telephone, power, TV cable. So all those things are underground, they're put in prior to the street or as the street's being developed. That goes in with permission of the developer. Once the street is in, then the plat is given final approval. But the municipality didn't have anything to say about how those utilities might happen. Now, I grant you that they could, if something like this passes, probably deal with it, but it's going to create some problems. Those were put in with the permission of the property developer. There are a lot of situations like that. We take them as they are. We have little choice in them. One of the situations that arises is that while a rural area is developing, the roads that are put into what's known as a rural cross-section. That's what's known as an urban cross-section. In that system, the street is lower than the surrounding property. So what happens is the municipality goes in to put in the urban cross-section with curbs, gutters, sidewalks, underground drainage and all. Lo and behold, when they take that 1 or 2 foot cut that's required to get from the rural cross-section down to the municipal or to the urban cross-section, the street is lower than the surrounding property. There are utility cables, which 20 years ago when they were put in were fine because they were deep enough that there was no interference. Now they're going to have to move just because they have to modernize the road system. So I think what you're doing to municipalities is telling them that it doesn't matter what they thought, it's going to be the relationship between the utility and the municipality in the future. They're going to have to pay for the relocation costs. There was no way they could prevent it, no way they could address it at that time because it wasn't contemplated. As for the future, there is little way we can deal with it in the future because we have to allow them to locate in the right way. Now, I grant you that the statute provides that we have to allow them to locate under reasonable terms and conditions. The APUC is the ultimate arbiter of what is a reasonable term or condition. I suggest that adopting this is going to create far more problems. Utilities are in the streets. Their ability to go in the streets is one which accrues to their ratepayers. We think that they don't have to go out by easement, private property owners. Therefore, they avoid a very large expense of putting utility in. We think that it's appropriate that they also pay for relocation costs that may develop later. That people will buy the ratepayer. They have the benefit of that location.
Is there any questions? Yes.
Yeah, I got a question. In reading section 2, it says that if the utility is not changed, basically the municipality can go out there and move it. But the owner of the utility, whatever it is liable. That's one statute, and then it goes on, and in section 4, reading the existing language, it says that the cost is a cost of highway construction to be paid by the state or municipality, notwithstanding the terms or provisions of any existing permit agreement regulation or statute to the contrary. Well, section 2 is a statute to the contrary.
Yes. That would certainly argue against the passage of the bill because it would seem it doesn't matter whether it's an unauthorized encroachment or not, we're going to have to pay for it. I think probably the way a court would interpret this, if you have all the statutes in front of you, the system is that if you determine that it has to be relocated, you order that it be relocated, and there be reasonable times and terms attached to that relocation. If the utility fails to relocate it, then it becomes an unauthorized obstruction and would not qualify for being it would be expensive. We'd have to sue the utility to get that back. But I'm sure they would raise this as a defense, saying, oh, wait a minute, all that means is if we don't move it, the municipality has to move it, but they still have to pay for it. It doesn't change who has to pay for it. I would say, yes, there is.
Sure. It seems like your most pressing argument is that notwithstanding language of the whole bill, because by adding a section to that section, adding municipality, the guts of it's all in the notwithstanding phrase in the top of page 2.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That notwithstanding an existing permit was put in the mid-70s when the definition of cost of construction was changed to allow the feds to participate in those moves. Because there were a lot of utility permits out that put the cost of the move on the utility. And in order to allow them to have the benefit retroactively of this law, that notwithstanding language was put in. But bear in mind, of course, that was the state of Alaska legislature talking about state of Alaska expenses. It's not like a dispute.
Well, it would seem that the section that we've got, the notwithstanding section, still should apply to the state. But the notwithstanding section may be a question, at least with regard to terms and conditions which the utility has agreed to with the municipality. Or maybe the construction should be that section 3 be two different sections.
Mr. Chairman, that would certainly give the municipality a better handle on dealing with the problem, respectively, as it comes up. It leaves unanswered those situations where the municipality didn't think it was going to have to deal with the problem, and they don't have anything in the permit that addresses that.
But that becomes a bad deal in a private transaction when the municipality made the mistake.
You may respond. Or you may not.
You know, a lot of times municipalities, you know, we look back and we say, well, gee, 20 years ago we made a mistake. But if we can put ourselves in the shoes of those who were engaging in transactions 20 years ago, we were talking about, say, the development of an area that where the roads still had grass in the middle of it. And we just weren't thinking in these terms. All we wanted to see was power out there so the folks could, so it could be developed and folks could have power. And now that's placed in solid subdivisions.
But the private,
serious problems.
But the private sector or a utility, privately owned a co-op has to pay for its mistakes. You know, I understand there's a lot of conditions that pass between them. I think there's two different questions in this. I think I agree with you on one about the other.
Yeah, we're thinking more.
No, I
know. Jenny, would you state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jenny Chitwood, Alaska Municipal League. Basically, don't have much more to add to Lee's testimony. Municipal League opposes Senate Bill 67. The bill amends Title 29 of Chapter 25, Protection and Use of State Highways and Roads, to circumstances with utility relocation. Sometimes they're municipal utilities, and the municipalities require that the cost of relocating municipal utilities be included in the rate base because they're enterprises in that area. Sometimes the utilities are privately owned, yet the lines are fully depreciated. We don't think it's fair in that case that the municipality pay the cost. In some cases, the lines are fairly new, and in those cases, the municipality should pay the cost. It's not the fault of the utility that they're in a place where they shouldn't be. But what I'm saying is that it's a case-by-case situation, and it should be decided on a case-by-case basis rather than a flat-out policy in state law. The same circumstances don't exist for municipal road projects as they do for state road projects, as Lee pointed out, where 95% of the cost is picked up by the federal government. It has been true in the last couple of years that there's been a lot of state money going to municipalities for state for municipal road projects. But from what all I'm hearing in the last month or so, that's not likely to be happening in the future.
Any questions by members of the committee? Yes, Senator Halpern.
How do you read the context of the Section 3, where it has the notwithstanding language, and it says existing permit, and then the added sentence on right-of-ways, and it goes on to say, on a valid easement permit. It seems like you're saying notwithstanding an existing permit, except that it has an existing permit.
Like a double notwithstanding.
Well, it's notwithstanding, except withstanding.
Yes. I know what the intent is. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you how we interpret it. The intent is that if a utility put their facilities in a place where they shouldn't be, that they should have to pay for their mistakes. If they put them where the municipality told them to put them, then the municipality should pay. That's the intent of that money. I'm not sure what's going to say.
Doesn't that cure the problem of the notwithstanding section?
Well, it takes care of some of it. It doesn't take care of a situation where a utility has agreed to pay for relocation in exchange for having the benefit of using the public right-of-way. And they've received a permit to do that, but as part of the permit, they've agreed to relocate. So they're operating under a valid permit, yet they've agreed as part of that permit to pay relocating costs. But the first part of the notwithstanding would then remove that obligation that the utility paid. The second part only removes the obligation if the utility is located someplace where they shouldn't be. So the utility has saved a lot of money by not having to buy public private land for a right-of-way and are able to use the streets, the public right-of-way, and have agreed to pay for relocation in exchange for having that benefit. Even though they've agreed to that and it's down in writing, this bill would negate the provisions of that.
So the one phrase is not covered. It's a negative and then a positive, but the piece that's left out is the agreement piece. Because the permit's covered, the right-of-way's covered, regulation or statute can both be done retroactively by the governmental entity involved. But where you have an actual agreement to pay for relocation, that's where the problem then still remains.
Well, I see it still remaining with the permit, because the only place where the permit comes into play is if they're located incorrectly. They're located correctly with a permit. The permit says they'll pay for relocation. That relocation part of the permit is negated by this bill.
I
You got to push your pass.
At this time, I'd like to assign committee substitute for House Bill 31 to Senator